The Strokes. The Yeah Yeah Yeahs. LCD Sound System. What do these bands all have in common? Well, if you're music journalist Lizzie Goodman, they were integral to the rock revival movement that came about in New York City at the dawn of the 2000s. It lasted about 10 years, from 2001 to 2011, starting right after 9/11 and ending with a massive farewell show for LCD Sound System at Madison Square Gardens in April 2011. So how did that decade revitalize the indie music scene in New York City, and what made it culturally significant? What role, if any, did 9/11 play in ushering us into this new cultural era? Lizzie Goodman details it all, as well as some unsavory bits. There's a lot of talk about drug addiction in the oral history compendium Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City 2001 to 2011. I had the chance to speak with Lizzie a couple weeks ago about the book. I'm on the phone with Lizzie Goodman. Lizzie, hello, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
So you have a book out, Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. I read that this book, which is sort of an oral history, it all started with The Strokes?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, it is an oral history, so all told in other people's voices, which is fun. The idea is to have it feel, my goal is to make it feel like you were kind of at like the dirtiest cocktail party ever, and overhearing all the conversations you would have wanted to witness it from bands like Yeah Yeahs and Strokes and Interpol and White Stripes and many, many others. But yeah, I think, I mean, my personal story and kind of way into this world was that when I was 19, I worked in New York City at a restaurant with Nick Valenci, one of the guitarists in the Strokes, and he and I were just kind of restaurant pals together, but he was in this band, and we stayed in touch and stayed friends, and so I kind of got to witness their rise from a moment where no one thought that would be possible to them playing Saturday Night Live. So I think kind of having seeing a friend go through that and have that experience was really inspiring in terms of understanding that, like, you know, rock stars are just like us and all that. So I think that was part of my personal connection to all the material that ended up going into the book. And certainly The Strokes are probably among the most important characters in the story.
What do you think it is about sort of that decade, those 10 years, that really lend itself to creating this musical identity within New York City?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I mean, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, it's the age-old story of kind of any underground subculture blowing up and then kind of disseminating around the world, and the reaction to that kind of coming back home. We've seen that happen in music, especially in New York with the CBGB's punk scene in the 70s, which this scene that I document, Meet Me in the Bathroom, is certainly most often compared to. But I think in some other ways, this era, the kind of early aughts, as they say, is unique because of, you know, it's a cliche to say it at this point, but it's true, because of the internet. I mean, the bands in this story, in some ways are experiencing a story that their forebears experienced, you know, getting discovered in kind of gross downtown clubs and playing dirty rock and roll and wearing leather jackets and you know, kind of the drugs and the lifestyle that went along with all of that is kind of evergreen New York City rock cool idea. But in the case of, for example, a band like Interpol, like, and all of them, but I think of Interpol often because their first record was kind of Turn on the Bright Lights was pre-internet, basically. And then Antics, their second record, quite famously leaked. It was one of the first big kind of indie rock record leaks that we all experienced. And there's this scene in the book where Paul Banks, the singer of Interpol, of course, is on tour in Europe, and someone comes up to him and is like, "Hey, I love Antics." And he's like, "Wait, what?" Like, it had, you know, they had basically just finished making it, and it had kind of already been stolen and sent around to all the fans. And right there, it's kind of like what you see in that story, and this is true for all of Interpol's peers that are documented here, LCD, Strokes, Karen O, Yaz, and all these people we're already talking about, is that the beginning of their story, they're in one world, and quite quickly, by the kind of next leg of their story, the next installment of their story, they're in a completely different world. And that transition from pre-internet to post-internet, I think, is, among other things, what makes this 10-year chunk so much more than just a story about, like, some rock and roll bands in New York City, and kind of turns it into a generational identity exploration.
You know, you say that the era ends with those two shows at Madison Square Garden, The Strokes and LCD Sound System. And I get the feeling that the era kind of started with 9/11 or right after that. Mm. Obviously, that was such a, yeah, you know, a big tragic event. But how did that maybe usher us as a society into a new sort of cultural period?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's hard to talk about because, you know, as you just said, it's obviously like a massive tragedy for New York City, for America, for the world in a lot of ways. And it's hard to kind of speak about it in a way that feels respectful of the magnitude of that event and also links it appropriately. I mean, this is what happened with the rise and kind of reinvention of New York City rock and roll. I don't know, you know, hindsight is 2020. I have no idea what would have happened to these bands had 9/11 not happened. I mean, probably much of the same, but I think in terms of fame and success, like, great rock records are great rock records and people connect to them. But I do think that there was an added level, that 9/11 brought an added level of attention to, in a global sense, to New York City during this time. And that these bands, I mean, we're talking about the first generation of these bands we're talking about from New York would be The Strokes and Interpol and the IAEAs. Those are the ones who kind of became founders of the story I'm telling here that were together already and making records when 9/11 happened. They, you know, they made this music that was dirty and kind of celebratory at the same time and was kind of defiant and had this sense of kind of American guttural grit, right? And, you know, in the case of The Strokes, Is This It was supposed to come out right around 9/11. I mean, they delayed it and re-released it with a new track list because they did not want New York City Cops on there because they thought the song would now feel offensive in the wake of that. So you have this music that has this tone and tenor of rebellion and of a specific breed of kind of American countercultural rebellion, and it's coming from this city that is known for its swagger and its toughness and its resilience. And then you have this event, this tragedy, this, you know, unprecedented attack on American soil, and everyone's eyes turn to New York City, and these bands inadvertently provided the soundtrack for coming out of that, for how to respond to that, for how to deal with the kind of trauma that we as a city and as a country were contending with in the wake of 9/11. So I think it does mark the beginning of this period for these artists in a particular way. Unfortunately, you know,
you've spoken about how you sort of had two types of reactions. You had, you know, some artists that were just really opening and saying, okay, you know, here we go, and then maybe, you know, others were a little more hesitant. How easy was it for you to get responses out of people?
Yeah, that's funny. I mean, it did run the gamut, that's for sure. Some people were really just psyched, you know, just up for it and kind of ready to kind of delve into what are often some really difficult topics about kind of inner band politics or drug use or failure or fear of failure, you know. It's really, really hard to be asked a bunch of deeply personal questions about the most, you know, the sort of foundation of your creative life that took place in a moment where everyone was partying a lot and were, oh, by the way, also children, basically. You know, it's hard. It's hard to be open about that stuff. So I was really, you know, just honored and impressed with some of the frankness that seemed to pour naturally out of certain characters' kind of frameworks for how to think about this. I'm thinking in particular about Albert Hammond Jr. from The Strokes, who's just so, like, open and poignant and self-analyzing without being sort of self-deprecating, like just really like proud to have participated in this incredible story and wanting to talk about it. And he's a great example. I would say James Murphy is a great example of that as well. Just kind of like just really wide-eyed and gracious, and it was really awesome. Yeah, guys too, there are a lot. Most of them were like that. And then there were other people who needed a little bit more coaxing or who wanted to talk about some stuff but not others, some subjects but not others. And that was fine too. I mean, one of the points of doing this as an oral history was to kind of, I really meant it when I said to people I was seeking to talk to, this is your story. It's oral history. I'm not writing it. I mean, I'm sculpting the narrative, but I'm not sitting down as I usually do when I write features and saying, hey, this is the story as I see it. I'm saying, this is the framework. Here's a framework that I've built. And now I'm going to put all of your, you know, come and say your piece. It's going to go in the big pile of other people saying their piece. And that, I think, really helped a lot of people participate who wouldn't have otherwise, because it was kind of like, unlike when I write a lot of magazine stories and other kinds of more straightforward journalism, and it's, you can't really give those sort of caveats. It's not like if you sit down to write a profile about someone or you're doing a serious reported piece, you can't say, hey, here's the list of things that you don't want to talk about that I'm comfortable with you not talking about. In oral history, when it's a story that belongs to the participants, you can, you know. And what's funny though is that a lot of the time when I kind of made that allowance, then when we were actually doing the interview, people who had seemed hesitant often wanted to talk about everything anyway, because once you're there and you hear what your friends have been saying about a particularly tough night or a particularly, you know, controversial recording session or a particularly controversial member of another band or something like that, when you hear that other people kind of weighed in on that, you want your voice recorded for posterity as well. So it was tricky. Some people were hesitant, but most people were like incredibly generous, and I was really grateful for that.
I think whenever you are talking about rock music and its character, the subject of drug use and addiction is always going to come up. It's always going to be a factor. Did that come up at all in your discussions? And did you get a sense that you sort of maybe see a common thread as to why so many artists in engage in those types of activities?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think it's not necessary, but it's often there. I'm thinking of this one moment in that Nick Valenti says, actually, or when he's talking about kind of the Strokes rise, which happened what felt like very quickly. And, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he says something like, I think we were talking about them being asked to play Saturday Night Live or some big event at kind of the end of the year where they released Is This It, which would be 2001, and sort of the pace of everything. And he sort of said something like, yeah, I think I may have asked him when he got that call or something else big, maybe a sales stat or something. Where were you when you found out that you were going to be asked to play on Saturday Night Live? And he said something like, you know, I don't know, or whatever. There's so many things like that happening at that, during that moment. You know, there's so many kind of momentous, wow, I really want to process this fully, lines in the sand that you're crossing in terms of success that are beyond your wildest dreams that you don't, you almost can't process them all. And he goes, he said all that, and then he sort of said, you know, for me, I just, I said, well, how do you process it? He's like, you don't. For me, I just did a lot of drugs, you know? And I think it's a story as old as rock history, right? It's VH1 Behind the Music on repeat. You get your child, you're 20, you're 21, you're 22, you're 23, you're even 24. I mean, you're a young person whose goal has been to do this thing that's almost impossible to do. And when it happens, there's a lot of emotion that you're not, that any person would have a hard time processing. And you're also on the road with all your best friends, removed from your kind of regular routines. And people are just out there asking you what you want 24 hours a day. You know, there's another line from Albert in the book that I love. It's just so heartbreaking, but it's true. He's like, I don't know how to explain it, but success depressed me. You know, he also talks about the moment where the band's rise, he noticed, had gone from, you know, we're backstage and there's a six pack of beer to people are knocking on my door at all hours of the night saying, you know, what can I get you? Basically, just the access to substances comes with the territory when you're in this kind of heady tsunami of success. So I think part of it is it's the culture, you know, and you're so freaked out. You're just like, and also, by the way, drugs are fun, so it's the thing to do, and it can be really illuminating for a while. I mean, I think drugs have a really important role in opening doors for creative people, and then also a really destructive role in shutting those doors and ensuring that you know you'll never have access to them again, or threatening that you'll never have access to those portals again. So that's one thing to say about it. And then the other thing I would just say is an important theme in the book, too, is the identity of one group of these bands when it comes to drugs versus another. So the book starts with all these bands we're talking about, these kind of true rock and rollers. And then it evolves into the Brooklyn scene and bands like Vampire Weekend, or Grizzly Bear, or The National. You know, these are artists who are also a huge part of this 10-year period in New York City history and in music history, and who are the torchbearers for the Strokes, CIAS, Interpol world that was launched at the beginning of this decade. And those dudes, especially the Vampire Weekend guys, talk so derisively about drugs. Like, they really weren't into that. And part of it is, that just goes to show you that part of it is, like, style. You know, the Vampire Weekend guys considered it kind of, like, passé to be the rock kid, you know, doing blow in the bathroom and wearing a leather jacket, because that was what their immediate predecessors had been doing. So it's sort of like that need to always define yourself against what came before you is also kind of shows up in a hyper condensed way in this 10-year period. You're getting all the cycles of kind of a scene rising with one kind of character, and then the torch being passed to a completely new scene with an entirely different ethos behind it in this really accelerated way because of the internet. So, you know, not all the bands in this book, despite it being called Meet Me in the Bathroom, and despite there being a ton of drug stories in there, it also does trace the way that different bands use and deliberately don't use substances to kind of shape their identity.
How have you found the reactions from a lot of people profiled in the book? I even understand that you yourself weren't entirely comfortable with everything that was said about you in the book, but how did you sort of navigate eventually what to include and what not to include?
Well, I mean, I'm not in the book, so I've been pretty lucky and grateful, again, for not being, I mean, I wrote the introduction. So I write an introduction that kind of sets up my own role in this world and my own connection to it, and explains kind of how, I mean, I've been working as a music journalist for 15 years now, but I started as a fan and as the kind of friend of just an accidental tourist in this world of like New York City rock bands during this era. So I do write about that at the beginning of the book a bit. But I deliberately kept myself out of the narrative as a character because I didn't think that it was journalistically feasible for me to kind of write myself into the story as a voice. It just seemed like two hats and I couldn't wear them both at the same time. The response to the book has been, there have been some people who are pissed off, but mostly the anger and or the upset has come from sort of just, like I said, this sort of sense of how hard it is to hear what other people are thinking or remembering or describing, how other people are describing particular moments that you've all witnessed. It's Rashomon, you know, the famous Kurosawa, you know, like gangster film where it's sort of these interlocking, that everyone's perspective of one particular incident when recalled will change. Like, they won't always line up. In fact, they'll almost inherently not line up. And so that's what's fun about oral history, is you often get conflicting narratives. People go, even about small stuff. I'm not even talking about like sexy stuff like drugs. I'm talking like, which song did you guys write first? And people will be like, no, it was this one. It absolutely was not. It was this one. There's sort of these wars between members of the same band, often about things that aren't even that controversial. And that's part of what makes it fun. But I think that's the nature of memory. So, you know, the dealing with the fallout of people feeling wounded about hearing their own past recalled to them from primary participants in it is part of the deal, you know? I have a lot of respect for all of the people who devoted their time to being in this book. A lot of them are my friends. It's been it's really a personal project for me. So I take that very seriously. But I also think, you know, one of the things that's been so gratifying about putting it out is just how little of that, considering how dirty and raw the story is and how much people showed up for their interviews. I'm really gratified at how little, I have been at least hearing, kind of sniping about what was said. Like, I know it's going on, but it's kind of, people have been really respectful about not throwing that in my direction. So I appreciate that. I don't know if that answers your question. But,
What do you think New York music is now? It seems like it shifted to maybe a little more poppy than it was in the last decade. Where do you think New York music is today?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that you really see in this book is that New York music and New York City itself, I mean, I always say that New York City is the primary character in the story. It's not any particular band or, you know, person. New York City exists everywhere. I mean, that was not true at the beginning of the reporting. I mean, the time that this book covers, you watched that transition take place. So the idea of New York, of this place, of the skyline, of Madonna, of Bob Dylan, of John Coltrane, of Woody Allen, you know, Manhattan, right? These notions of what it is to be New York City, to be in New York City, these images of it are so important and huge and shaped. I mean, they made me want to come there. I'm from the Southwest originally, and it was like the great crush of my life, New York City. And that's the real theme of this book, is how everyone who's in it feels that way, is drawn to New York as a kind of mecca for an identity that they hope to forge for themselves and can't even really give name to yet. It's this kind of primal call, right? And that idea used to have a geographic place. It was downtown Manhattan, Lower East Side, East Village in my era, in the era that's covered here. I don't think it has, and then it moved to Brooklyn in the second part of the decade. I don't think it has a place anymore. I don't think there is New York City music, the sound of it. Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say, yeah, everything's gotten a little more poppy and everything's gotten a little more sort of multilingual, and I think that's the response again to predictive text culture, to the kind of soup of influences that we're all living in all the time. Like, you can just hear everything all the time, so there's all these kind of, there's a lot of creative crosstalk going on, but I don't think there really is a New York music anymore in the way that we used to mean that, like a thing made by people living in the same geographic location, as far as I can tell, it's not happening like that right now. So I think the way that people reference New York, the way that people feel connected to New York, is still going on. That's evergreen. But you might never even come here, and you might still be kind of a New York artist, because that will be the language that you're tapping into. It's a really weird and interesting time to be following culture. That's for sure.
Well, the book is Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. Lizzie Goodman, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Such a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
All right, have a good day. Cheers.
You too. Bye.
And you can get Lizzie's book now. It's available wherever books are sold. Here are The Strokes with Last Night. Once again, that was The Strokes with Last Night. We turn now from indie music to independent film. David Hyde is the writer-director of a new crime comedy called Stegman is Dead. I got sent a screener and I laughed uproariously. Ostensibly, it is a caper film that deals with the other side of criminals, or, as Hyde likes to put it, the parts of their lives we don't see. At its heart, though, Stegman is a morality tale that has a beautiful father-daughter relationship at its center. Starring Michael Eklund, Michael Ironside, and newcomer Linnea Moffitt, the film is out now. Last week, I had a chance to speak with writer-director David Hyde about the project. David Hyde, hello, and welcome to the show.
Dan, thank you for having me.
This is a lovely little scenario you got going on. While we're talking, you have a guy remotely accessing your computer. As a film person, how do you feel about technology and our relationship to it and how it affects our relationship with others?
That's a real sidewinder of a question that I wasn't expecting. But here is what I have to say about that. The democratization, and I don't mean to get too lofty here, but the democratization of technology has literally changed the face of the film business. I'm old enough to have been being a director back in the days when music videos were huge and MuchMusic was still playing them. And I was making music videos on MuchMusic and we were shooting everything on film. And there was a time where you couldn't make something that looked professional unless you had upwards of $500,000 of equipment at your fingertips. So what that meant was there was only very few people who could be directors and who could make films and make anything that was actually professional grade. That's obviously changed. In the last 10 years, everything's completely flipped on its head. So what does technology mean to filmmakers, and what does it mean to story, and what does it mean to creative? A huge amount. It's no longer just this sort of subsidiary thing that happens after the creative happens. Technology and creative are fully intertwined in the year 2017, and I think it's an incredibly important thing to stay on top of, to use as a tool in storytelling.
And I think the other aspect of that, before we get into the film here, is the impact that social media has. And I talk to on-screen talent about this a lot and how it affects their relationship with their fans. But as someone who's more prominent but behind the scenes, how do you feel that social media affects that part of your life as an artist?
Yeah, it's deeply affects all of us, obviously. And I love social media. At the same time, I'm highly irritated by it because it takes so much energy to stay on top of. And you can't succeed and be a winner unless you are fully on top of your social media end of the game. So, you know, it adds to the list of things that you've got to do as a filmmaker or as a professional creative in any way. You know, you've got to be creative and you've got to be on top of the contemporary things that are happening. You've got to continue writing and continue making your disciplines. Are we still going?
Yeah.
You've got to, you know, it's just one of the things on the long list of things that you have to do now to continue to be in the loop and on top of your game. So I love it and hate it at the same time.
So let's talk about the film. You got a film out. Stedman is Dead. I love the title. What I really like about the film, actually, is the opening title sequence. It's for me, it's a little bit sort of like, I almost described it as dystopian hip-hop. How important does sort of an opening segment, whether it's for a film or for a series, because they're very popular in series, how important is that for setting the tone of whatever it is that you're making?
Yeah, so I consider that to be incredibly important, and that's evident in Stegman, because we spent a huge amount of time setting this thing up. You know, I mean, there is Marshall McLuhan had talked about the medium, not the message. It's like the ribbons and bows upon that you package things in are what make it really what it is. The oldest television series running is Law and Order. And if I said to you, if I hummed the theme of Law and Order, you would know it and I would know it. And everybody who was plus or minus 30 years of our age would know it. That's how important packaging and ribbons and bows are. Bom, 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 bom. Like everybody who hears that knows what that television show is. So when you create something, in order to be able to get your idea across, making the packaging of that stuff is really very, very important. And we spent a lot of time. I really love your description of the dystopian hip-hop thing. It's super funny because we had a music supervisor on Stegman who's amazing. His name is David Heyman. He's got a brilliant company. And he went and had sent me a bunch of tracks, and he found this unbelievably great band from Alberta named The Dead South. And he said to me, look, why don't we take this song? The Dead South does sort of like old style strings, bluegrass sort of music, and fusion-esque. And he said, why don't we take this even further and combine it with hip-hop? And I had sent him some references of bands that I loved, like Gangsta Grass and the opening of a TV series called Justified. And so we went along this strand, and he hired a rapper from Scarborough. He licensed the track from the Dead South in Alberta, and we wrote custom lyrics that were then like rapped out by that rapper, and we made that amazing track that I truly, deeply love. Then, on top of that, we wanted some images, and I found a company in Mexico, some excellent animators, a couple of guys who graduated from Sheridan College in Toronto, went back to Mexico, started their own company, and I outsourced the title sequence to those guys. And I was like, here's the music, here's a couple of thoughts, go ahead and make some animation. And they did a brilliant job, and Low Stegman is a low-budget independent feature. We only had a certain amount of money. You know, in Canada, making a minute and 15-second animated opening for your film will cost you plus $10,000. And we were able to do it much less expensively, and we outsourced it to these guys, and they got paid fairly, and they were happy to have this on their reel. They were also very, very skilled, and just in a position where they were looking to continue to build in the direction of making more film-oriented credit sequences. So it was a win-win for all of us. And the amount of energy that went into what I just described to you is how important I think it is to create beautiful openings and beautiful interstitial elements for your programs and for your films.
I think the relationship, particularly in Canada, I noticed, between filmmakers and indie musicians is very strong. I noticed that specifically in a lot of Canadian projects. As a filmmaker, when you're looking for the background music, do you consciously go after Canadian talent? Is that important to you as an artist?
I mean, the answer is yes and no. Yes, it is important to me because it just is. But ultimately, I always let story prevail. So what I'm looking to do is elicit the exact kind of response from the viewer that I'm looking for, and that doesn't possess a nationality. It's like I would use whatever was out there to do the best thing. Certainly, you know, you source homegrown first, man, because it's right in front of you and it's generally excellent and it almost always does the trick. But I say that because it's just an efficient way to get what I want. It's not a compromise.
I love the sort of the style of this film. It's, you know, crime comedy, which has been around for a while. And the main character is a thief, which I find interesting. And you're sort of blurring the lines of reality or morality a little bit. Are there any sort of universal morals and universal truths, do you think, out there? How can we decide what is moral at any one time?
That is the best question I've ever been asked about Stegman is Dead. And I've done a ton of interviews, and you nailed it. Although it was a bit of a circular thing, but here is the trick about Stegman that I don't talk about very often just because it seems so hoity-toity. But when we wrote this film, it really is a morality tale. And it's about the morality of a certain kind of person who lives on the outskirts of the norms and mores of the regular society. So, for instance, I could say the word gypsies, which is now sort of like old school and not proper because it defines a group of people that incorrectly. But nonetheless, if I say the word gypsy, you understand what that is, which is a group of folks, and they lived outside of cities, and they were famously known for wandering, and they were famously known for stealing other people's stuff. But within the gypsy tribes, they all had their own code of ethics and honor. That's a set of morality. And that exists outside of the regular norms and mores. So that's what we did with Stegman, was we wanted to say, okay, look, what happens to criminals in between the time that they're committing crimes? Because when people commit crimes, that's when you see most movies being made. Ocean's 11, it's a bunch of crooks trying to rob a bank, and you see how, or trying to rob a casino, and then you see how they do that. Stegman is Dead is a bunch of crooks outside of their regular time, with their wives and with their children and at their mama's birthdays and doing these things that are more normal life. But just how do these people come to those normal life situations with their own set of norms and mores? Then down the road, of course, Stegman turns into a heist film and a get back the blackmail stuff. And so it sort of more lines up with what you talked about, the traditional crime comedy kind of stories.
Where do you look for comedy in crime. You always hear these stories in the news about this person getting arrested for just the most ridiculous thing. But on a much more deeper level, where do you look for the funny in sort of the dark?
Yeah, listen, I mean, the thing about it for me is that I don't look like it's always just there. And I just have that kind of sense of humor. The moment I saw the guy in Fargo put the arm through the wood chipper and the blood comes out of the top of the wood chipper and you laugh instead of get grossed out, that's when I understood that dark comedy really was my thing, and it hit that twinge inside me. I am able to really enjoy exploring those kinds of moments. So it's like I don't look out there. I'm not working at it, but I just think it's funny certain scenarios that take place in those kinds of like high tension, high drama circumstances.
John Cleese praises black humor, dark humor, and the innate funniness of being offensive. Why do you think we as a society laugh at things that make us uncomfortable?
I think it's because we're all looking to be comfortable. You know, like the more you can laugh at the things that you are told are wrong, the more you realize that in fact those things are not as wrong and not as bad as you thought they were.
I think another aspect that I enjoy that's being used as a comic device, specifically in your film, is sort of the strings of curse words that your characters utter. What makes swearing so funny, especially in the context that it is used in Stegman?
Stegman made a really tricky balancing act between not just the swearing, but the violence and the adult themes, because it's really a father-daughter story. So there's a professional criminal who is a thief, and he has a six-year-old daughter. So on set, we had a six-year-old all day long, every day. Set in that kind of context, swearing becomes absurd. It just becomes a silly thing. It's not a serious, scary cowboy thing. It's more like a ridiculous adult thing when you're confronted with the genius and clarity of thought that six-year-old children bring to the table. So that's why in our context, swearing kind of becomes funny, because it's so inane.
Working with children, you know, in the old days it was thought that performers should never work with children or animals. But as a director, how do you find working with kids? There's something very natural, I find, about a lot of the acting styles of child performers.
100%. And we worked really hard in casting to make sure we got that. You know, we were way out on a limb when we cast Linnea Moffat to play the role in Stegman is Dead. And here, let me just, I don't know what to do. All right, let's turn this off. Sorry, my phone's on.
We can edit that out.
Okay, what was it?
We were talking about Linnea.
Yeah, and just why she, oh yeah, so kids are working with children, right. So the brilliant thing about kids is they have an extraordinary clarity of presence. And our casting director, Jim Heber, put up a whole bunch of children in front of us, and we were able to make some choices. And it was funny because the child actors that he selected to come forward first, I mean, this is a fairly lead role. It's like a second role. It's really, Segment's more or less an ensemble, and one of the major roles is for this six-year-old. And I saw a bunch of professional child actors. And then at the end of seeing that bunch, we decided that we just didn't have the right person. And that was because a lot of those kids were very, very well trained, and they were all bringing big saucer eyes and the classic kind of kid approach to their performance. I said to our casting director, "What else have we got?" And he said, "Well, listen, we don't have anything else. We have nobody else who's qualified to do a role of this size over this duration of time." Because you're absolutely serious, you know, you're seriously concerned. Can a six-year-old work 7 days in a row, 12 hours a day? Or however many legal hours there are in a day for a six-year-old. Not 12, whatever it was. Probably. We ended up casting the son of our casting... No, we ended up casting the daughter of our casting director's brother, because our casting director knew that she would be fantastic. And we all went together on this risk. She came in. Linnea did an audition. And she was in that very, very centered and amazing place that some children get to just before they turn 10, and she was our choice. And so, you know, we took the risk.
How much did you work Michael Eklund on... how much did you work with Michael Eklund on cultivating that relationship with Linnea, or did you let him take the lead on that?
No, we were... Listen, you know, when you're directing a film, I was the co-writer on that film, I was a co-producer on that film, and the director on that film. And so it was... I had a lot of fingers and a lot of pies, and it was my first feature film directing job. So Michael and I, of course, came together, and we had a strategy as to how to approach this. Linnea and I came together, and we talked about her character, and we had a whole construct about how she was going to proceed. But Michael Eklund then came to me and said, David, listen, during off hours, I'm going to spend some time with Linnea, which, by the way, they don't have to do. And he built a relationship with her, which made it 100 times easier on set. And had he not done that, we probably wouldn't have gotten the kind of performances we got. You know, I think that some of the best moments in this film are just between he and her. Michael Eklund and Linnea Moffatt are some of the very best moments in this movie. And that's because Michael spent so much time making sure that they had a proper working relationship offset as well as onset.
The other actor I want to bring up is Michael Ironside.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he always sort of gets a reputation for playing heavy, but I found his character hilarious. Where did you get the idea to cast him? Did you know that he could be funny?
I had no idea he could be funny. And you know who it was? Was our producer, Juliet Hagopian, found Michael Ironside, and she fought tooth and nail to get him on our film. We couldn't afford him. And we convinced, you know, or Juliet convinced her agent to give him the script. And he had other jobs that paid better than our job. But it was the script that convinced him to show up. And it was all through the really smart casting choice of my producer, Juliet Hagopian, that we ended up with Michael Ironside on our set, you know?
As a director, and as you mentioned, this was your first feature as director. Is there a bit of that intimidation factor when you're directing not only somebody like Michael Eklund, but Michael Ironside as well, who's this iconic figure in cinema?
Oh, God, yeah. No, I was scared shitless. And I was very, very conscious of trying to deliver to Michael Ironside all the materials that he needed to do well in his role. We block shot him, meaning that we took all of his scenes and we put them together and we shot them days in a row. Those days happened to be the last 4 days of shooting. So we shot this film over 20 days. The first 16 days were exhausting. And then Michael Ironside showed up on set and I was tired and worn out and malnourished and stressed out and underslept. And he was very challenging, man. He did not let me get away with anything. And he wasn't helpful in the beginning. He was very, very challenging. And he had rewritten his lines and he would tell me how to direct scenes. And the first morning we were together, it was seriously contentious, like swear word contentious. And then once he realized that I was able to do my job, and that I was able to manage him, and that I actually had some thoughts that he was interested in hearing, he was won over, and we've been friends ever since. And he gave us an excellent performance.
The last aspect I want to bring up is the sort of the humorous way that sexual deviance comes into the script. There's the octopus, I think, famously. What is it about that, that lifestyle and how it can seem absurd to other people in a way that makes it a good comedic device?
Yeah, well, listen, I mean, Stegman Is Dead exists way outside the boundaries of reality. It's a film that's a B film and knows it's a B film. It's ironically poking fun at itself and at the circumstances that it presents constantly. So Stegman is a porn director, and he's made his fortune creating octopus porn for the internet. But he's a bumbling, lovable character who just wants to be an honest filmmaker. The reason he's blackmailing hitmen is because he needs to make a whole bunch of money in order to be able to create his own real film. So there's sort of a circular story there as the tale unfolds. There's these funny and ridiculous beats that come forward in the context of the film that aren't offensive. You know, when I say the words porn and octopus porn, that's really can be a very, very sensitive and very offensive topic. But within the context of how we package it, it becomes absurdist and therefore comedic.
Well, the film is Stegman is Dead. It stars Michael Eklund and Michael Ironside and Linnea
Moffitt.
Bernice Liu. Great film, great cast. David Hyde is the co-writer, producer, director, and I believe it's out now. David Hyde, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was David Hyde, the writer, director of the great new Canadian indie crime comedy film, Stegman is Dead. That does it for me today. Friday, I'm super excited. We have a lovely chat with Allison Quart from the Big Comfy Couch. She'll be on the show talking about her life as a voice performer, as a children's entertainer, her work on Comfy Couch, her work with the new version of the Magic School Bus, video games, and being at fan conventions. You'll also hear from Ron Diamond, as well as the music of Heavy Hearts. The Patreon campaign will be starting up again soon, so patreon.com/EndeavorsRadio, and of course, downloading on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn. Taking you out with the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and Date with the Night. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.